From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn about new affordable housing projects in Milwaukee's North Side neighborhoods. Then, we learn why UW-Milwaukee decided to do both online and in-person classes this fall.
We're working very hard to develop the best online courses, but we heard from our students after the spring that it didn't seem to give them the same learning opportunities that they had in a face-to-face environment.
Plus, we talk about the new Jon Stewart film, Irresistible, a political satire set in small-town Wisconsin.
Maybe the challenge to satirists of all kinds in 2020 is that the world itself has become so absurd that it's really hard to almost to make fun of it, because it already is sadly funny.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Despite the pandemic, construction has continued on new projects in the Milwaukee area. Although many of us are more focused on this health crisis, social unrest, and economic turmoil, we're still experiencing a shortage of affordable housing. That shortage, mixed with the financial burden of housing, adds even more stress to these issues. Here in Milwaukee, there has been a renewed interest in building affordable housing, including a large project coming to the city's north side. Tom Dakin is a reporter who covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about that project, along with other projects in Milwaukee's north side neighborhoods.
Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So there's a pretty big project that's happening on Milwaukee's north side that could have a very big impact on the city. Tell us a bit about it.
Yes, it's called the Community Within the Corridor. It's a mix of both affordable apartments, around 200 units of affordable apartments, as well as commercial space and community space, some facilities that would be open to people in the neighborhood to use, as well as serving as a amenity space like a fitness center for the residents of the apartments. And it's being developed in one of the more impoverished neighborhoods on the city's north side. This is in the 30th Street Industrial Corridor, which is the old urban industrial area of Milwaukee that had dozens and dozens of manufacturers throughout much of the 20th century, and it ran along the railroad tracks, which went, not surprisingly, along 30th Street from approximately where Miller Brewing is and Harley-Davidson, all the way north up to, past Hampton Avenue. This particular location is around Center and 32nd Street.
What makes this project so significant for that area, looking at things beyond just the sheer size of this project?
Yes, well, I mean, it is a large project, and it's a $59 million investment that, in a neighborhood that has not seen much real estate investment or really any kind of investment for decades. As a matter of fact, what it's seen is what we call disinvestment, when companies pull out and jobs disappear, and then, well, not surprisingly, we get crime and an increase in drug and alcohol addiction and all the other social ills that accompany situations like that. So it came about because a young African-American developer, Q. Elamine, he has a company called Scott Crawford Incorporated, which is named for his grandparents. Q. Elamine, he wanted to take these buildings and turn them into affordable housing with the use of federal tax credits for that purpose. These buildings also date back to the early 1900s, so they qualify for historic preservation tax credits. Those two types of tax credits, by the way, approximately account for about $37 million of the $59 million cost. The problem is he's just starting out in the development world, and by himself, he did not have the financial capability and the depth of experience and the track record to be able to go to a bank and get a loan and to get equity investors to help complete that financing package. So he approached local development companies here in the Milwaukee area, as well as I think at least one, maybe more than one in Northern Illinois, and was turned down. As he told me in the story I wrote for the journal Sentinel and JS Online, he wasn't really surprised by that. I mean, disappointed, but not surprised given the location. Fortunately, an architectural firm, Continuum Architects, that he was working with, had worked with on another site, they knew about a development company out of Minneapolis called Roars Companies, led by a man named Brian Roars, because Continuum was doing work for a project they were doing, a market rate apartment project down in Walker's Point, where they were converting an old industrial building to high-end apartments. And Continuum introduced Brian Roars to Q El Amin, and Brian Roars decided this was an investment that he wanted to get involved in. And what was interesting was, from Q's perspective, that was because Brian was from out of town and didn't really come into the situation with any preconceived notions about that location beyond what you would look at on black and white in terms of developer. In other words, the demographics of the area, incomes, how many people live in the area, what are the odds of attracting people to rent affordable housing there, etc. And as a result of Roars getting involved, and as a result of Q working very persistently to obtain those tax credits, as well as Continuum helping to maintain the historic preservation tax credits, that's kind of a niche of that architectural firm. This is all now coming together. They've gotten a commitment for a bank loan to fill in much of the private financing gap. And right now, as we speak, they are going through the Common Council review and they hope approval process for about $3 million in city funding that would come in the form of a tax incremental financing district. And your listeners are probably familiar with TIF districts. Basically, that money will come from the new property tax revenue generated by this development.
Yeah. You know, as you mentioned, development on Milwaukee's north side has been stunted for a long time. It hasn't grown in the same way it has in other parts of the city. But in the last couple of years, it seems like we've seen more and more projects that are showing up in these neighborhoods. Can you talk about a few of those?
Oh, sure. First of all, let's talk about one that has not really launched yet, one I'm sure most listeners are familiar with, and that's Century City. That's the business park that's replacing the former A.O. Smith / Tower Automotive manufacturing complex at approximately Capitol Drive and in Hopkins, roughly. You might recall Strauss out of Franklin was going to move their slaughterhouse and meat processing operation there. That was going to take up most of that. That got defeated after some of the neighborhood residents objected. There are a couple of industries that are active there. Telgo, which makes passenger rail cars, leases space in one of the few buildings kept from the old A.O. Smith days, and then Good City Brewing leases space in a new building that was built there. So that still needs to truly launch and get going, and it's been hurt in part because at that location, when you're trying to attract industries and distribution centers, they usually like to be a little bit closer to the interstate system, and that's a little bit of a drive from I-43. But then let's talk about some areas that have been more successful, and one that I continually talk about that I think a lot of people just aren't aware of because it's, for let's be blunt, for a lot of white people, it's out of sight, it's out of mind, but that's the Harambee neighborhood. And that's the neighborhood that extends north of downtown from roughly North Avenue going all the way north up to near Capitol Drive, kind of along Martin Luther King Drive is sort of the main north-south route. And we've seen over the years, and especially in recent years, affordable housing developed in that neighborhood, again, driven in part by tax credits. We've seen also, though, some various commercial developments, restaurants and other businesses coming into that area. And right now there's a big project pending just south of North Avenue, which is in the Harambee area, that and also the Hellyer Park neighborhood. And that's the conversion of the former Schuster's department store, one of the grand old department stores from Milwaukee's past that ceased to be a department store by approximately the early 70s. And it's being converted into offices for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Medical College of Wisconsin, and then some affordable housing. And Royal Capital Group is taking the lead on that, and that's another development firm run by a younger African-American man.
Well, like that project, some of these developments are really still in the works. And this is something we talked about a bit before this conversation, but there are a lot of protests that are going on and a lot of unrest in neighborhoods throughout the city, throughout the Milwaukee area, but specifically in Milwaukee's North Side neighborhoods. Is that a threat to development? Do developers see these kinds of social movements and say, well, maybe let's hold off on building there?
Well, when I did the story on Community Within the Corridor, the folks from Roar's company said, no, we're not tapping the brakes. We're going forward. And as I mentioned earlier, they are right now in real time proceeding to get city approval for the last one of the last chunks of the financing package of that TIF district. So it hasn't stymied that. In the Harambee neighborhood, when you talk about quote-unquote unrest, we should probably differentiate here between peaceful protests, which has been the majority of the activity, people exercising their constitutional rights, their civil liberties to make their feelings known. Let's separate that from the incidents of crime, people vandalizing buildings, people breaking into buildings and stealing things. That was really confined to roughly that first weekend after the killing of George Floyd up in Minneapolis. And some of that did happen in the Harambee neighborhood, specifically right around the intersection of Locust and King Drive, where there's a district Milwaukee Police Department station. And I did a separate story in the aftermath of that and talked to people who work there and have property there. And I think the prevailing view is that it might slow down development, but it's not going to stop development. I think it was summed up best by a gentleman named Randy Crump, who has been active in construction development for decades. And he said, there's still opportunities here for people who aren't afraid of black people. If you're a developer and if you don't have an inordinate fear of black people and you don't have an inordinate fear of neighborhoods that are mostly African American, look at the demographics here, look at the income characteristics, the availability of workforce, the proximity downtown, the availability of mass transit. You're going to see the benefits of coming here. By the way, incidentally, Mr. Crump, Randy Crump, he runs a company called Prism Technical Services, and they're a firm that's hired by developers and general contractors to consult with on obtaining hiring disadvantaged businesses and disadvantaged workers for different projects. And he also, incidentally, is the father of Lafayette Crump, who's been nominated to be the next city development commissioner, awaiting confirmation from the Common Council on that.
So recognizing this is a fairly loaded question because we're in the middle of an economic downturn and we're in the middle of a pandemic, which has made a lot of kind of future planning difficult. What does the forecast look like for Milwaukee's North Side neighborhoods?
Well, given that some of these projects we've just been talking about, Community Within the Corridor being one of them, some of the other ones that have an affordable housing element, I think actually the forecast is pretty good because affordable housing is one of the main components in many of these developments. And with affordable housing, it's usually just a matter of competing to obtain the tax credits from the federal and in some cases state governments. The typical history of developing affordable housing in Milwaukee and many other cities is those units get leased up just like that. I mean, you get them under construction and people are lining up to reserve them. So there'll always be a demand for affordable housing. And typically, restaurants and stores want to be near where people live. So when you drive population growth in a neighborhood by adding apartments, you get more demand for restaurants and supermarkets and hairstylists and, you know, you name it. That's what often drives that type of growth.
Tom Dakin covers commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's a regular Lake Effect contributor. He spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find more of their conversations at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn what classes will look like at UWM this fall. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee announced last week that it would reopen its dorms and classrooms this fall. But campus life will look a lot different. To protect students and employees from the coronavirus, everyone will have to wear masks, classroom capacity will be reduced, and a lot of work will still happen online. WUWM education reporter Emily Files talked with two administrators in charge of academic planning for the fall. Scott Gronert is Dean of the College of Letters and Science. Johannes Britz is UWM's provost. They told Emily that even though classrooms are reopening, about 70% of courses will remain online in order to ensure social distancing. Gronert starts out by explaining the process the university went through in reaching this decision.
In the end, the scenario that was recommended and where the campus came in is one that is going to be majority of the courses will be in an online format. Almost all courses will have some sort of online component to them, but with that, we'll also have a large portion of courses which will be face-to-face. I'll point out that in a given semester, 20% of our enrollment is online anyway. 44% of our students during the course of a year will take an online course. So when we say that we are having mostly online courses, we always have a lot of courses online. And we're focusing the face-to-face courses on the areas where the experience is diminished more so than other courses by taking those online. So we're not at an extreme, at either extreme of almost all face-to-face or almost all online. We're in the middle ground, but tilted towards online. Our estimate right now would be that somewhere around a third of our instruction would be face-to-face and two-thirds would be online. But that's, again, a projection of where we are right now. And that aligns with what I was saying, is that we're not tipped wildly to one side or the other. We're in middle ground.
So from reading the scenario planning report, it sounds like taking social distancing into account and having only like quarter capacity in classrooms means that space is really limited and just a few classrooms really would be able to hold more than 30 students. So could you talk about how that is playing into the plan and the limitations that that creates?
Right. We're looking at a number of hybrid options that allow us a little more flexibility. And one that was outlined is that taking our classes and splitting them in half and only having half of the class meet on a given day. It's a term sometimes used, a flipped classroom, where you're using the classroom for active learning and then online for doing some of the content. By doing that, by splitting the class in half and meeting only once a week, what happens is, with only half the students, a class of 30 now looks like a class of 15 from the social distancing perspective. And what that can allow us to do is take a lot of our rooms that really only are suited for that number and utilize them. So that's one of our strategies to create more opportunities for students for face-to-face. And I might just add that we surveyed our students and it came back that we had a good number of students who really wanted the face-to-face experience and were very had strong opinions about that. We also had another group of students who very much wanted the online experience and had a strong opinion about that. The ratio was about 2-1. And so that's another part of this. We're trying to create choices and options for our student body.
So could that potentially involve having both options? Like if it's the 101 psychology or something like that, having a in-person or hybrid option and a fully online option?
Right. We're very much focused on, as much as possible, giving students the option so that if they want the face-to-face experience, they can find that on campus. And if they want the online experience, they'll have that option too. We can't do that in every course because in some cases we're only offering one section. But even if we're only offering one section with a face-to-face class, we're going to ask our instructors to create online content for those students who can't be in the classroom.
And I think, Scott, to that point, Emily, that, you know, if you do what the Psychology 101 option is also then for faculty an option or instructors, the ability to be online or do the face-to-face component.
Okay, we'll get back to that in a minute, but with the class, the plans for classes, will they be extended to having classes on the weekends to limit capacity? Has that been decided yet?
Yeah, so we will not change the week for now, and also not the calendar. And so in other words, we will start the same time. We will, you know, continue after Thanksgiving. But we also have the backup plan should there be a spike or something that we can flip immediately to an online version, because you don't know what's going to happen. But we did build that in to our planning. But the fact, as Scott said, you know, the dean, if we can do the flipped classroom, we don't have to add days to the week for scheduling.
And we looked at a whole range of things, of extending the the hours of the day. Many universities have looked at that. And we looked at extending the campus into other spaces. And we're still thinking about those maybe in special cases where there's some course we really can't fit into our schedule, but we want to. But we decided that in part they added extra complexity, and there wasn't the benefit that was going to come out of that. The thing is about a university is that it's constantly moving, and students are enrolling in courses for the fall during the spring semester. Almost we have that overlap, and so as we're thinking about the classes for the fall, students are already enrolling in the classes for the fall, and so we're cognizant of that, and we don't want to disrupt these students' schedules. Many of them are almost already have their full schedule for the fall.
When do you expect to have details about which classes will be held in which format?
My projection, Scott, would be early July to have that done without committing to a specific date. We really want to get that out so that people can be prepared and that they know what are they going to teach. And Scott can add a little bit more, I think, to that planning.
Yeah, so we'll be looking to our departments and programs to give us guidance as to what courses are most important to them to be face-to-face. We'd already surveyed before of courses that are really diminished by being online. Now we're going to look at courses that aren't so critical, but we think will enrich our student experience and bring those into face-to-face. And it'll just take a couple of weeks to sort that out with guidance from our departments, their chairs, and our staff and faculty in making those decisions. Some of these decisions about courses are going to be rather straightforward. We have no capacity to offer a class of 300 face-to-face on our campus. Those courses on that scale will have to be in online format. So those sorts of things. But I agree with the provost in that sort of time frame.
It's going to be quite the puzzle to put together.
Yeah, it's so many unknowns and so complex, and you have very few things that you exactly know how it is going to play out.
So when it comes to how faculty and instructional staff feel about being back in the classroom with 20 students or whatever the number is, what will be the process and what will happen if faculty or instructional staff say that they don't feel comfortable teaching in person?
For us, it's a very important question, you know, and we did talk about that already earlier on. And I think, Emily, the baseline here is we do care for our faculty staff, you know, their safety, their concerns. And as far as you can, you will, of course, accommodate those. And that's why, actually, even in a classroom, we have social distancing, mandatory masks, protocol in cleaning, et cetera, to ensure that there's a safe environment. And if you, you know, as the dean explained, you know, we will have 25% to 30% of our classes on site. We will prioritize those courses in terms of what is needed. The rest will be, in any case, in an online version. So if there are serious concerns that people do have, that they must have, you know, the ability, the freedom actually to interact and express those with a department, a head of a department, or a dean to see how they can accommodate that. You know, and then if you look at it from an HR perspective, if they are faculty or staff with some serious health or, you know, medical conditions, or they're in their household, that there is a route that you can actually take it through HR, should that be needed, to find an accommodation for that very specific health-related condition that people have. So we try to be as accommodative as possible. I don't know if Scott wants to add a little bit, Scott, from your end.
Yeah, and we're the process that we're using, because for any course to be face-to-face, we're going to have to move it to a different classroom, which is larger and which can accommodate it. So the process is going to be identifying courses that we would move to be face-to-face. And that process is going to be engaging, as Provost said, the department chairs, program directors, and their faculties in this process. So we're looking at, again, having everyone engaged in the process. And as Provost said, we only were going to have 25 to 35% in a face-to-face environment. So most of our instructors are going to be teaching online.
And just to clarify, when you say the 25 to 30% in a face-to-face environment, will even the face-to-face classes will be a hybrid approach?
Right. We anticipate some amount of hybrid instruction in all of our courses. And let's say a lab or studio course, it will get almost completely face-to-face because that's the sort of environment they're in. But for other courses, we'll use full hybrid methods of meeting one day a week and other content online, or even more fractional amounts of hybrid. That is that courses probably will be ending a little bit earlier than normal to create more time for students to move between classes and not get bottlenecked. That's another one of our social distancing strategies. And so that missed instruction time by ending a little early will be made up by online content. So we're going to have a whole spectrum from mainly face-to-face in our experiential learning courses all the way out to, let's say, a 50-50 hybrid and everything in between.
Just final thought. Why do you think it's important to have some return to face-to-face instruction in the fall?
You know, a lot of our students, their learning styles don't work as well with the online course materials. We're working very hard to develop the best online courses, but we heard from our students after the spring that it didn't seem to give them the same learning opportunities that they had in a face-to-face environment. And so that is a part of the driving force. We look also, one of the priorities was developmental courses in freshmen. Students that really need some level of interaction to thrive within a university. And so those were the reasons. And then finally, there's just certain things like in laboratories and studios that we can mimic it online, but the students don't get the same quality of educational experience if they're doing it online. So those were reasons that we felt that giving students choices was important.
Scott Gronert is the Dean of the College of Letters and Science, and Johannes Britz is the Provost of UW-Milwaukee. They both spoke with WUWM's Emily Files. For more information on UWM's fall reopening plan, you can go to wuwm.com. Coming up next, we discuss Jon Stewart's new Wisconsin-centered film, Irresistible, with our film contributor Dave Lerson. Like Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Campaign finance, dark money, super PACs, political campaigning? Well, sounds like a perfect comedy to be set in small-town Wisconsin. Irresistible, written and directed by late-night talk show veteran Jon Stewart, aims to be a civic lesson wrapped in a realistic absurdity with a touch of Midwest nice that we're known for. The film follows Gary Zimmer, a Democratic political strategist played by Steve Carell, who uses running a mayoral campaign for a Wisconsin farmer as a way to come out of his post-2016 election slump and to re-energize the heart of the Democratic Party that was long neglected. But Stewart's target is not just the Democratic Party. Actress Rose Byrne stars as Faith Brewster, the Republican National Committee closer that also descends on the small town from Washington, D.C. to ensure the Republican incumbent mayor wins the re-election. The dynamics between the setting of fictional Deerlochen, Wisconsin, and the way D.C. outsiders descend to create change, while on the surface may seem like entertainment, is not far off from the truth of how America operates. To discuss more about Irresistible, I'm joined by film contributor Dave Lurson. Dave Lurson, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you. It's good to be back, even though it's virtual still at this point.
Exactly. Well, this also impacted the movie we're going to talk about right now, Irresistible. It's the newest film written and directed by Jon Stewart. It was slated to open in theaters last month, but due to COVID, is going to be released on demand on the 26th of this month. So how about we just set the scene for our listeners about this new political comedy from Stewart?
Well, yes, political comedy is the word here. I say it pokes fun of both parties, certainly, but the primary objective of this film is the Democratic Party's loss of connection with blue-collar voters, the loss of connection that many activists within the Democratic Party have worried about, that loss of the heartland, of all those people who routinely are denounced for voting against their own best interests and supporting the rightward drift that led to the rise of Donald Trump. There was a book out either earlier this year or late last year by the Nebraska or Kansas Democratic Party chairwoman describing how the Democratic Party can find, you know, common ground pretty easily, really, with a rural constituency. One of my favorite political writers, Thomas Frank, has been on this case for several years now, talking about the Democratic Party's need to focus less on special interests and more on a broader appeal to the common good. And so Jon Stewart, I think, is taking up this position here by looking at an East Coast elite leadership of the Democratic Party that is fumbling around trying to figure out how to make these connections.
Do you think that this issue is taken up well, kind of in this little more digestible format of film with comedians and people that we know?
Well, I suppose it will appeal to more people than would read a policy-length book or watch a documentary on the failure, real, imagined, or exaggerated, of the Democratic Party in reaching rural and blue-collar voters. Because, you know, it's the value of taking a serious idea and making it entertaining, adding a little bit of humor. It's an age-old way of getting a message across.
Right, and I kind of enjoy how it plays off that news has essentially become entertainment, so why not make it even more entertaining and educational and put it in a movie?
Yeah, certainly nothing wrong with that at all. I think the peculiar thing about the release of the movie is that it comes at a time when we are all distracted by different kinds of social and political issues, and maybe if there's a downfall to Irresistible is that, you know, had it been released in March or April as originally planned, it would have seemed very timely, and now, I mean, it doesn't really have a whole lot to say about Black Lives Matter, but, certainly not COVID-19 and the response to the pandemic. So it seems like it's a little, you know, late to arrive. It's not quite timely in the way that Jon Stewart may have hoped it would be.
Right. So obviously the world of film and pre-production cannot timely respond to current events, as you said. But do you think that the film was maybe too broad? What did you think of the overall feel of the film? You know, it starts off setting the scene. Steve Carell's character, Gary, is a top Democratic strategist, and it shows the aftermath of Hillary losing the election. And of course, Wisconsin was a big noted news event that Wisconsin wasn't won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that Irresistible reflects the frustration that many Democrats and people of progressive political bend felt toward the way the Hillary campaign was run, the way that the Hillary campaign did seem to ignore some obvious sectors of the United States. I mean, she didn't visit Wisconsin during the campaign, and it became a sore point for a lot of people. This film is definitely amplifying this frustration and putting it into a comical light.
What was your opinion on how the film wanted to capture small-town Wisconsin in the heartland of America? Of course, you have rallies that include a fish fry and a polka, but did you think they worked well and had some Wisconsin consultants, or what did you think of, you know, basically their interpretation of our state?
Well, yeah, I had read very little about the movie in advance, and the information I had was kind of sketchy, so I was taken by surprise that the beloved fictional town of Deerhaken, Wisconsin, was the setting for this. In the aftermath, I found out more that it was actually filmed in Georgia. So is Georgia a good stand-in for Wisconsin? I mean, I guess I didn't see anything that struck me as being really out of place. There were no palm trees in the background, no mountain ranges that don't exist in Wisconsin. I think it was okay. I think where it excelled was getting at the sort of Wisconsin upper Midwest sensibility that maybe we take for granted here, the kind of easygoing, have a good one, temperament of the average person interacting with each other, which seems very strange to the Steve Carell character. I mean, he feels like he's landed on a different planet where, you know, people talk this way and offer you, you know, free bakery from the oven and this kind of thing. I think that there certainly is a lot of truth to that and the way that Midwesterners are compared to some other regions of the U.S.
Right, that Midwest nice is contrasted so plainly with Steve Carell's character, his strategist Gary. And then when he gets involved in highlighting the character known as the Colonel, played by Chris Cooper, in running a campaign for mayor, he gains the attention of Rose Byrne's character, Faith, who is basically the Republican strategist nemesis. So what did you think of the two of their performances? Because clearly these are D.C. outsiders coming to a small Wisconsin town, so the character interplay is very prevalent in this movie.
Yeah, they both come armed with a great deal of money to support two different mayoral candidates, the incumbent Republican being supported by the Rose Byrne character with lots of PAC money, and the Chris Cooper character, the dairy farmer and Marine Corps veteran that Steve Carell is getting behind. And, you know, they're both obvious outsiders, Rose Byrne and Steve Carell's characters in this town. They both manage to, gather together groups of supporters behind their particular issue. And, of course, it becomes a nationwide media spectacle, battle for the heartlands, a partisan test case. Can a Democrat, the Chris Cooper character, win in a rural constituency such as Deerhaken, Wisconsin? And so to do this, I mean, you know, the advertising campaign that Steve Carell devises is really, you know, it's frighteningly realistic. There's a TV ad for Cooper, tempered by war or driven by faith, a new kind of Democrat. It's not too much of an exaggeration from the way TV ads are, with the ominous voices and the dramatic orchestration of music and all this kind of stuff. And this becomes maybe the challenge to satirists of all kind in 2020, is that the world itself has become so absurd that it's really hard to almost to make fun of it, because it already is sadly funny. And what can you do? You can exaggerate further a little bit, but then again, you find real life examples of things that are more ridiculous than the exaggeration you are conceiving. So I take nothing away from John Stewart's effort here, but again, I think that people like him have a much harder time in 2020 than they would have in 1980 or 1990.
Well, that's an interesting take on it, because I was wondering before sitting down to watch it, you know, if that late night explainer approach could be transferred from the world of late night comedy into a feature film. So how did you think Stewart did in writing and directing this?
Well, I think he achieved that goal. I mean, it has that kind of sensibility and will certainly appeal to his audience. Did he hope to reach beyond his audience with this? Are the real-life people from towns like Deerhawken going to flock to this? Well, would they have flocked to theaters to see this? Or are they checking it out on video on demand right now? I have a feeling that the answer is no. I think that the message of this film is really directed toward elements of the Democratic Party to energize them and make them aware of some of the deficiencies that occurred with the previous presidential campaign.
Yeah, and in the credit scene, we won't give away the twist of plot for our listeners, but of course in the credits you kind of go back to a late night example of interviewing an expert on the way the system works, how campaigns are done, super PACs, dark money, all of these things. But I also think the film did well in delivering what could have been a very complicated story about the intricacies of campaign finance in a very concise way. You know, for the first time, we were close to the traditional 90-minute film.
Yes. No, I gave him a great deal of credit for being able to distill complicated, wonky, you know, kinds of things, you know, campaign finance. What does this look like today post Citizens United? How does it work? How does it not work? What is the effect of all of this? How do political consultants attempt to determine specific demographics and demographic groups of people to reach them? I think, you know, again, it's frighteningly realistic. And again, the challenge is okay, I mean, this is funny, but I mean, this is real life. I mean, it's not too far removed from the reality of the situation, if it's removed from it at all in any measurable way.
Right. The whole question of why do we accept that this is how things work, you know, and how the average person from Deerhawken, Wisconsin does not benefit from this system.
Exactly. So it does make the point quite well. And I would have to say that for all of the spoofing of Steve Carell's character, I think that Faith Brewster, the Rose Byrne GOP strategist, comes off much worse.
Indeed. Well, overall, I did enjoy the little break, I suppose, from one news topic to another, but put in a very pleasant Wisconsin way, I suppose.
Yes. Well, and I hope it does find an audience of people. I think it deserves a good look and a couple of laughs.
Dave Lerson is the arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express and one of our regular film contributors. We talked about the new Jon Stewart film Irresistible, which is available on demand this Friday. We'll take one last break and then learn about the COVID-19 journaling project. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We are, without a doubt, living during a significant time in our history. Between the protests and the pandemic, this is a huge moment in our collective history, and we're all experiencing different things, and it's important that people in the future can learn about our experiences. There's perhaps no better way to do that than through firsthand accounts. In 1861, the Wisconsin Historical Society's founder, Lyman Draper, asked soldiers stationed at Camp Randall in Madison to help document the Civil War by keeping a diary. Today, these documents are incredibly valuable as a way to experience history. Now, the Historical Society is asking the same of us through its COVID-19 journaling project. The project is seeking people of all ages to keep journals in any format, from writing in a notebook, on your computer, recording audio or video. To learn more about it, I spoke with Simone Munson, the Wisconsin Historical Society Librarian Archives Collection Development Coordinator. Simone Munson, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here.
So what was the first crisis the Wisconsin Historical Society worked to document in real time with everyday Wisconsinites?
You know, the Wisconsin Historical Society was founded back in 1846, and some of our founding members definitely had this idea of documenting history in real time. Probably one of our most well-known founders, his name was Lyman Draper, and he had a real interest in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, and he did research in that. So when the Civil War started brewing and things related to the Civil War started happening, he definitely saw that as an opportunity to be capturing history as it happened. And so he really encouraged soldiers that served for Wisconsin Infantry to keep journals and diaries to document their experiences in the Civil War. And really, that was the first opportunity that the Historical Society had to do this collecting in real time.
So we may think that history needs to be in books we read in school or already be a time well before our modern lives with modern technology, but what's happening right now is historical.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we often sort of take for granted that the things that we're experiencing today will one day be in history books. So the pandemic and things related to, you know, world health are definitely something that will be talked about in the future.
So what are you asking people to do now to add our voices to this historical event?
Yeah, so the Historical Society has come up with something we're calling the COVID-19 Journaling Project. And really what we're doing is we're encouraging people to keep journals in any format that they want to. It could be a traditional, you know, pen and paper kind of journal. It could be a photo journal. It could be an audio recording that they do every day, just to sort of get down the events of what is happening in the world, how people are coping with this situation that we're living in, and kind of help us create a really strong timeline for how the pandemic happens, how it's unfolding, how people are dealing with it, and then how people kind of come out on the other side and what we're seeing after this event is over.
So given that a lot of things are developing, is there a timeline for how long you want people to journal?
So the way that the project is set up is that we're hoping that people can keep a journal for 30, 60, or 90 days and go from there. Obviously, if things last longer and we need to keep journals for longer, we can do it for longer. Or if someone started a journal back in February or March documenting those earlier days before we were all kind of told to go home, then we would love to have those kinds of entries too. But if you go to our website, which is wisconsinhistory.org, there's a way that you can register for the journal project. And when you register for the journal project, we're asking people to kind of make a commitment to either 30, 60, or 90 days of journaling. And if that changes or we have to make adjustments, that's totally fine.
So what would you say to encourage people from all walks of life and jobs and current situations to participate? Perhaps someone thinks, I'm just trying to survive day to day. You know, what do I have to contribute to the bigger picture of what's happening?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that historians and archivists are always looking for is information on the experiences of everyday people. And sometimes those are harder to find than what we would like. You know, we often think of politicians and people that are involved, well-known figures, that their letters and papers and things are the things that get saved. But really, historians now are really interested in what was the experience of day-to-day life and how that was affected. The other thing I would say about this specific pandemic and kind of crisis that we're living through is that the sort of people who aren't traditionally in the limelight are suddenly getting more attention and sort of being, you know, cast into the limelight, sort of jobs and things that we don't often think of and maybe we take for granted on a day-to-day basis are becoming just vital to survival and existence. And so there's something really valuable in having the experiences from a wide spectrum of people so that we can sort of document that for future generations to understand.
There's also a lot of kids home from school, and perhaps journaling and writing might help not only take up some time and be an activity, but maybe help them process things a little bit. Are you looking for voices of all ages?
Yeah, definitely. We've begun conversations with some school teachers. There are a few teachers in the area that are doing it as a school project. So their entire class will be keeping journals for the duration of the time that they're home. And even parents that are, you know, struggling with homeschooling. I am a parent of four, and I am definitely always looking for things to come up with for my kids to do while we're home. And, you know, having them have like a quiet reflective time where they have to, you know, write for 5 or 10 minutes, or even just keep like a Word doc or something like that, where they're just writing online for 10 minutes might be a useful thing to help them process. Yeah.
So say I'm sitting down and trying to start a journal, but don't know where to begin. Do you have any helpful tips for journaling during this pandemic, especially if people don't practice writing a lot?
Well, there are some writing prompts that are listed on the website. So if you end up going to the website to register for the project, there are some writing prompts there. We're really asking people to just sort of think about their everyday life and what they did each day, how they passed the time, what they encountered, how they felt about certain news articles and things that they saw online or just, you know, heard about. But there's also like a wide variety of writing clubs and writing groups out there. So if you have access to the internet and you just, you know, Google search like a writing club, there's endless amounts of groups out there that can help you get started with writing prompts.
So what's your hope, not just in collecting stories, but for the people who will contribute to this journaling project?
Yeah, so we're sort of hoping that the journaling project will do a couple things. Like we said, that we really want to collect the stories of a wide variety of people, that we're not just hearing the same voices over and over again. So we're really hoping that, you know, all ages and professions and backgrounds will be submitting journals so that we have really a wide variety of voices in the collection. And then the other thing is that we're hoping that it does serve as like a reflective tool, that people can see this as an opportunity to sort of think about how they're doing and use the time that they're spending to write or photograph or create some sort of artistic expression in a journal to sort of help them deal with the situation that we're living in. You know, one of the pieces that we've noticed as we've worked through the project, as our staff has worked through the project, and as we've sort of been developing materials, is that there are a lot of corollaries to these big events that have happened in the past. So whether it's the Civil War soldiers who were keeping journals, or the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that came through, that we're seeing that a lot of the things that happened in those moments of crisis are happening again today. And so kind of the patterns that we see in history and the human experience are really coming through.
Simone Munson is the Wisconsin Historical Society Librarian Archives Collection Development Coordinator. You can find out more about the COVID-19 Journaling Project at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.